Kaserne vor dem großen Tor steht ne Laterne und steht sie noch davor. Dort wollen wir uns wiedersehen, bei der Laterne wollen wir stehen, wie einst Lili Marlene, wie einst Lili Marlene. Unsere beiden Schatten sahen wie ein aus, dass wir lieb uns hatten, das sah man gleich daraus. Und alle Leute sollen es sehen, wenn wir bei der Laterne stehen, wie einst Lili Marlene, wie einst Lili Marlene. Deine Schritte kennt sie, deinen schönen Gang, alle Abend brennt sie, doch mich vergaß sie lang. Und sollte mir ein Leid geschehen, wer wird bei der Laterne stehen? Mit dir, Lili Marlene, mit dir, Lili Marlene. Aus dem stillen Raume, aus der Erde Grund, hebt sich wie im Traume dein verliebter Mund. Wenn sich die späten Nebel drehen, wer wird bei der Laterne stehen? Mit dir, Lili Marlene, mit dir, Lili Marlene. Wenn sich die späten Nebel drehen, wer wird bei der Laterne stehen, mit dir, Lili Marlene, mit dir, Lili Marlene.
White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. White Aryan Resistance Network Radio calling. Here's Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, in the bunker here on a beautiful day here in the Midwest. April the 29th, 2015, Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. We're at P.O. Box 401, as I tell you all the time. We're still there. 46581, Warsaw, Indiana. Spelt just like Warsaw, Poland. In fact, the whole county is called Kosciuszko, which was named after Count Kosciuszko, that was one of the best friends of General Washington in the Revolution. Came over and helped him out. And Washington thought so much of Count Kosciuszko that he ceded him millions of acres, or hundreds of thousands of acres, but I know it's a lot of acres out here on the, this was the Wild Wild West at the time. And thus, I live in Kosciuszko County. That's right. Eventually, though, the Germans pretty much took over the county. And there's a lot more Germans in this area than Polish. The Polish tended to be north of us in the manufacturing areas like South Bend, Mishawaka, and so forth. And a lot of Polish up that way. Anyhow, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. And up north of us, a lot of Italians, too. And I want the story, man, I've told many times. My uncle was from Italy and came over here in the 20s. And lived in that area, had several kids, and his oldest daughter, when she got married, they had a wedding party after the wedding, and I went to it, but the wedding lasted 3 days. I didn't stay there 3 days because I was too young. I think my dad wanted to stay there 3 days, but my mom wouldn't let him. Talk about a party. Talk about a wedding party. Ooh-wee, that was the biggest party I ever went to. Yeah. The Italians and the Polish got together, and boy, they know how to party. My Italian uncle made shoes and repaired shoes and had a thriving shoe business for many, many years in the area where he was living there. Incidentally, where he lived, south of South Bend, Indiana, any place on his property, you could lean over and pick up an arrowhead. There were thousands and thousands of Mongol arrowheads all over the place and Indian beads. Yeah, at that time, and there still are. That was called the Potawatomi tribe of Indians or Mongols. Yeah. Well, I was watching, happened to tune into a documentary today that came up on Hulu, and it was called The Last Nazi. It was about Albert Heim, and he was a doctor at Mauthausen concentration camp, and they picture him much like they did Dr. Mengele. But this Jewish guy's running this investigating group, and they've looked all over. They've tried everything. They can't find him. And he's supposedly, his son said he's dead. Died. He lived in Egypt for a long time. These Jews were looking all over Chile and all over the place. But in fact, he lived in Egypt. And he had quite a fortune. And shows you how sick the Germans are and Americans are and all that. They won't let the children have his estate. He has several million dollars in his estate, and they froze it, and his kids can't get to it until they prove the father is dead. Well, you know how that goes. So, but at least his first wife lives in a beautiful, beautiful home there in Baden-Baden, Germany. That's a very beautiful area, Baden-Baden. But I want to know, like I keep asking, when they're going to start prosecuting the war criminals on the other side, the Allies. And this crap about just the Germans were involved in genocide. Well, that's bullshit. Americans did it. British did it. Japanese did it. Russians did it. They all were responsible for millions of death. Even if it's the fact that warfare itself is a crime against humanity or a crime against races. World War I and World War II, the greatest crime and genocide was against the flower of our youth from Europe, United States, Australia, all over the place, Germany, Russia. The powerful leaders caused the death of millions of white people. And yet, they're never tried for genocide. They go on and on about Germany this and Germany that. But Germany is certainly no more guilty than any other country that involved themselves in international war. Do you ever think of that? How many millions of young white men and women and civilians too were murdered by the war machine? They don't want you to think about that, do they? And also the pot calling the pan black with the Jew war criminals. The Jews have just as much blood on their hands, and maybe more, than any other group of people. And why isn't anybody out looking for their war criminals? Not only against the recent Palestinians and so forth, but against all kinds of people down through history. People say, why do you hate the Jews? Well, I think that's not a good question. I would say, why do the Jews hate the white race? In fact, why do the Jews hate all races? Is it because they're not a race themselves and they're jealous or what? That's a question to ask. My main gripe against the Jews is something you never hear. A portion of the Jews were the foundation of the Christian virus, which has been the cause of tens and tens of millions of deaths for the last 2,000 or 3,000 years. At least 2,000 years. With this horrible myth of this non-existent Jesus. Hundreds of thousands of people going to war over somebody who never existed. Or even worse, going to war against a so-called God that doesn't exist. We can say Mother Nature, we can talk about evolution, we can talk about things that are provable. But to kill millions and millions and millions of people over something that doesn't exist, isn't that a war crime that goes on yet today? Aren't the American mothers and fathers who promote their children going into the military and going to some other country and occupying it and droning it and dropping bombs on it, aren't they war criminals? Your local church, where they get all excited and they're real happy when our side murders their side. Doesn't that make those people in that church war criminals? And all the big evangelists who talk about killing for Christ and all that kind of stuff, and how they're going to be a end of the world war, and the blood's going to run up to the depth of the bridle bits of the horses in the Middle East, and how they're praying every day for that war to begin, because otherwise Jesus won't come back. Jesus is not going to come back, they say, until you have a genocidal war of vast proportions. And even the Jews won't escape it, because they've got to fall down on their hands and knees and worship Jesus, or they're going to be iced again. But think about it. I don't have to think of too much that the Jews do today, but that they were the very foundation of the Christian virus. And of course, it's still going strong. I see the Pope is going to go to Cuba now. Going to go to the United States and go to Cuba, and they say he's such a great person because he is in the forefront of eradicating world hunger. Are you shitting me? The Catholic Church has done more to keep people hungry in the world than any other church. Keep them hungry. Keep them giving all their money to the church. Devoting their lives. Just think of these nuns and priests never have sex or anything, or not supposed to have sex, over this mythology, this virus that they live by. It's amazing. Watching this last Nazi is quite interesting because of the informants involved. And you know all these Nazi hunters? It's obvious the National Socialists didn't have this tremendous, powerful, secret syndicate in waiting to take care of all these people and never let them be caught, because they let a lot of them be caught. And I mean, you know, if they had such an intricate, powerful syndicate protecting them, how come these Nazi hunters spend decades tracking them down? Why wouldn't they be blown away in the first step they made? Very simply, every time a Nazi hunter went out, they'd be blown away. But they haven't been. None of them. Including Wiesenthal, who's not around anymore. So, to me, that puts to bed the myth that the National Socialists after World War II had an elaborate protective. Now, I'm not saying that they didn't get help, but I'm saying that they didn't fight back either. If people were so fanatically National Socialists, you'd think that you'd have thought over the years that any time one of these so-called Nazi hunters went out, they'd barely step out the front door of their house. But that's not the case. They've got a 317,000 euro reward on this Albert Heim. It's very interesting. They went all over Chile and Argentina and everything, and then find out he was lived in Cairo, and his son claims he's dead and was buried in a mass grave, which the Jew doesn't believe. I find that a little bit difficult too, because he needs to be able to prove that his father died to open the accounts, all these millions of dollars that his father had in the banks. Well, we've got the same problem here. They've been screwing our people for a long time. We have hundreds of people who have been snitched on, lied about, in prison, languishing in prison today while their informants are still walking around. Now, you know, you can go to one of these right-wing National Socialists or Klan or whatever rallies and they rail against informants and all that kind of stuff. But it's not hard to find these people. I know where a lot of them are myself. But yet, has any of them ever been taken care of? No. I find it quite interesting. And I'm not letting myself off the hook either. It's a precarious job to take care of things like that. And that's why I believe that our time is not now, is not yet. Because it's going to take men and women that are not on the scene today. And I've said that for decades. They're not on the scene today. The kind of people with the fanaticism and the ruthlessness to absolutely take care of things. They're not there. Now, you know, you can fantasize about it, and you would like to do it, but it's not been done. That proves in itself our struggle has not begun to peak yet. It's going to be a long time till it does. Because it's our shame, and future generations are going to say, it's our shame that we didn't take care of business. They not only, as I was talking yesterday, inform, cheat, lie about people, but when they're caught doing it and all the information's out, they come right back and get involved again. Like Glenn Miller did. He's just one person. There's a hell of a lot more of them. But he came back, got involved, worked with VNN, in which VNN's been warned many times about him, so obviously the leader of VNN doesn't care. I can't understand the mentality, but it's there. So here's a guy who was responsible for the persecution and torture of many people in the racial struggle. That just bides his time, then comes back, gets involved, and then due to his alcoholism and whatever he does, goes out and kills people who have nothing to do with the struggle or the problem. I mean, just normal people. They're not even Jews. And then our struggle takes the blame for all of that stuff. Because these people, and it happens all the time, like the guy in L.A. that was going to go into a Jewish day school and kill everybody. Remember him? another fruitcake. We've had several of them. None of them seem to have the intelligence to decide on something that's very important and take care of that. I mean, and they're walking around, you know. Thomas Martinez, I'm sure, is walking around Philadelphia, probably telling all his stories about destroying and Robert Matthews, his friend. There'd been a whole lot of these guys. As far as I know, none of them have ever been touched by anyone in the struggle. Now, Morris Dees, they say that there have been five attacks on Morris Dees. Well, of course, now he's so damn old and sick and screwed up that it'd be a waste of time. But I used to read about this stuff, and I said, how many guys does it take to take care of one situation? Give me a break. If I would have been a mind to, I've been within arm's reach of Morris Dees dozens of times. If I'd have been a mind to put him away, it would have been simple. So how come five guys did all his time in prison, evidently, for planning to get Morris Dees? I can't figure these things out. As far as I'm concerned, you got to be pretty goddamn dumb. But anyhow, that's the struggle goes on, and we're going to have to move to another level as time goes on, and we will be pushed to another level. I don't think I'll be around, but it's going to happen. We won't choose the next level, but we will be pushed into the next level as this country slowly sinks in the mire of the third world. And that's just the way it is. The white race is not going to rise up and do anything drastic or meaningful. If they rise up, they'll do the wrong thing. They'll come looking for us because we caused them all the problem. If we weren't talking and yelling and supporting the white race, they wouldn't be in trouble. They want us to shut up. That's why all these white hypocrites that surround you are so vicious. They want you to shut up. If you just shut up, they'd leave us alone. Shut up. You can belong to the Republican Party and play your little game, your Southern strategy. You can be in the Democrat Party and play that little game. You can be in the Klan. You can be in all this stuff, but just don't become effective. Don't take the war to the enemy. Don't do that. Just shut up. Go away. And if we can, we'll put you away and we'll help whoever's your enemies. And they're actually their enemies too, but they don't want to admit it. Yep. Yep. They want to put you away. They've tried it many times with me, including contract killing that luckily didn't happen, 2 assassination attempts, firebombing of my house, all that stuff. But somehow I lasted and lived through it. And somehow I've been smart enough not to believe the bullshit that informants and agent provocateurs spoon up to me. And that's why we have the lone wolf concept. I don't believe anybody. I'm a skeptic. And anyone comes around me and says nice things about me, I'm immediately suspicious. Isn't that a hell of a way to live? But I do all right. I can laugh with the best of them. I can drink beer and stuff with the boys. I can play a game of pool. I can sing karaoke. I can go hiking. I can go fishing. I can do all that stuff. I can do all that. And I feel fine. But as far as people approaching me, I never trust any of them. And you shouldn't either. Like the lone wolf in the forest. The most wary creature out there in the forest. He don't trust nobody. He don't trust any other animal. In fact, he's trying to kill him. He needs a meal. Of course, my favorite animal in Africa, you might be very surprised, is the baboon. Oh, you probably laugh your ass off at that. That baboon is one of the most intelligent primates going. Baboons work in packs. They have divisions like in an army. They have agents sent out ahead to check on things. In South Africa, they've always had a big problem with baboons going onto the farms and stealing things. They steal clothes right off the clothesline, really. And they're one of the most ferocious animals that there is, and that's the baboon. If you want to know about human nature, study animals. I spend a lot of time studying animals. I love these documentaries. The killer bee killed types and all their different defenses and how they work. Even the insects and the birds and everything, you know. I like this guy that goes looking for monster fish. Man, he's got balls like cantaloupes. I've never been much of a swimmer. And I've never been much to enjoy going way down deep in the water, even though I was a scuba diver in California for several years. But I was scared out of my mind a couple of times when I thought I'd had it and was going to drown. It's scary down there, man. And when you get disoriented and you don't know what's up from down and you happen to finally think, well, you just watch where the bubbles are going. Yeah, well, I've done a lot of things that were scary that I needed to do to test my manhood, so to speak. But I did them just to show I could do it. So anyhow, if you want to learn about the great tactics that should be adopted by man, study the animals. It's all there. Nature's given us the information. In the meantime, I hope all the informants and agents listen to this, because you know there is a TV show Alan Funt used to have called Candid Camera, and the byline was, when you least expect it and when you're not looking about it, bam, you're on Candid Camera. You can go for years, you can go for decades. You can go for a lifetime, just like they're hunting down these old Nazis. You know, you can hunt down your old enemies. It don't make any difference how old they are. So they're never going to be safe. But so far, they've been quite safe. Quite safe. You know, I have a problem sometimes delineating which way I should go, whether I'm should be more have more feeling from the general white race or hate their guts. And I vacillate on this. It's one of the things I struggle with. Having empathy on one hand and having absolute hatred and might is right on the other. I don't think I'm ever going to get that all figured out, because At one time, I feel empathy for white people and sympathy for white people. And at the next time, something will happen where I'll say, well, screw the white race and let's just take care of our own comrades and forget everybody else. I think I'm going to do the rest of the show on screw everybody and take care of ourselves, reading from the great book, Might is Right. Well, let's start with Chapter 5 of Might is Right, Man the Carnivore. It is, you know, the thing that really bothers me is the denial of people that we're a part of the animal world. That's what floors me, the Christian idea that we're separated from the animal kingdom. That is ridiculous. And the more they preach that stuff, the wackier it gets. It has taken countless evolutionary epochs to make man what he is. The most ferocious, hirsute beast of prey that inhabits the caverns of the jungle of Earth. Can his osseous mechanism and pathological instincts be summarily extinguished or reversed merely by connecting him per an electric wire laid through the sewers of Rome to the feeble dynamos of Bethlehem and Tarsus? Can his structural anatomy intended for conflict and slaughter be transformed in a day, a year, or even a million suns? To overmaster and devour his neighbor in the reasoned effort to obtain food and booty and land, love, renown, and the gold is bred into the very marrow of his bones. Therefore, all efforts made by reformers and messiahs to transfigure him into a lamb are foreordained to be fathomless failure. Indeed, it would be much more reasonable for them to attempt the transfiguration of a grizzly bear into a parlor poodle, or propose the transformation of a bald-headed eagle into a gently cooing turtle dove. Nearly all the prophetic demigods of democracy, from Paul and Isaiah to Carlyle and Ruskin, have ever been madly screeching by the roadside, vainly endeavoring to stay the march of a world of bannered armies striding grimly, sternly by. What are the howling prophets of evil but dogs, eloquently baying at the moon? Right wheel there, right wheel, back turn back, you're going to the devil, is their resounding, hair-splitting chorus. The human flood sweeps on silently, scornfully, confidently, inspired, as it were, by some overmastered instinct. Quote, we may be going to the devil, unquote, is the unspoken retort of these thundering legions, these nations, quote, but even so, is not the devil honest, the destroyer of deception, the disobedient one, the disobedient one? Can you lasso the stars with a green hide lariat? Can you block the march of the might and with magnificent howls of declamatory despair? No, no. Skyward or hellward, man moves on and on and on. If there are barricades in his way, he must surmount them or blast them aside. If there are wild beasts ready to spring upon him, he must destroy them or they will destroy him. If the high road leads through hells, then those infernos must be besieged, assailed, and taken possession of. A, even if their present monarchs have to be rooted out with weapons as demonic and deadly as their own. The world is too peaceful, too acquiescent, too tame. It is a circumcised world, nay, a castrated world. It must be made fiercer before it can become grander and better and more natural. Fools indeed are they who would arrest the unfolding process with humanitarian cagliarosism and rescue the perishing mummery. Maniacs are they who would ward off the sun's blazing rays from withering souls or the blighted frosts of the winter from hearts that are already broken. For I doubt not, through the ages, one tremendous purpose runs. The maturing crops are ripened with the process of the sun to be sickled down, threshed, and rolled away. Undoubtedly, black magic of the Christ myth, combined with the subterranean sorcery of medieval sacerdotalism, has partly succeeded not only in sapping individual initiative, but also in suppressing in our race many of the ancestral leonine traits and superb barbarian virtues. But as yet, it has not wholly triumphed in its emasculating decrepitancy. No, it has not transfigured us all into teams of contented oxen and bunches of earmarked sheep, although that is a final hope. There are some of the grand old stock left alive. You better believe it. Few indeed are they amidst the world of slaves and swine. The lion is still the lion, although his teeth have been most foully filed down by abominable moral codes, his skin made scrofulous with the mange and leprosy of caged peacefulness, his paws fettered by links of slave-voted statutes, an iron collar of state officialdom wound around his regal neck. Sometime, he is destined to break through the vile bonds that have been cunningly laid on him, escape from the wasting decline that originates from unnatural confinement, and regain once more his primitive freedom of action. The treacherous legislature, the illustrious statesmen who are now so eager to teach him the method of growing wool like sheep and how to fit his battle-scarred shoulders to a horse collar, may then be sorry and sad if they have time, for he will probably chew them up. Great and powerful governments commanding peace come into existence only in ages of decadence, when nations are on the downward grade. Now, you see that right now in our society? All these countries yelling peace, peace, peace. Of course, there is no peace. If the human animal lives a natural, clean life out of the plains and the forests away, where ocean rollers crash along the shore or on the banks of the pouring rivers, he requires no police force to protect him, no usurious Jew to rob him of his harvest, no tax-gathering legislators to vote away his property, and no priests of the idol to save his soul. It is false standards of morality that debase and enfeeble individuals, tribes, and nations. First, in obedience to some sovereign code, they lose their hardihood and increase their numbers. Then, that all may live, they become laborious, submissive to regulations, and finally, with death held by the priestcraft as fearsome terror, all personal valor fades away. Thus nations of spaniels are manufactured. I notice this quite a bit on these television shows, like the one who talks about greed and all these guys who have conned people, sort of like they've conned people that deserve being conned because they're so stupid. And then they go on a run, and then somebody turns them in. Well, I think that whoever turns them in are assholes myself. I think that predator class probably does a service in the long-range history of man, that they're almost needed. You know, like even almost like if there were no Jews on earth, we should have a few in a zoo or something, just so people could go there and look in and say, that's what we used to have giving us trouble all the time. We've kept a few of them for you to see. And I'm not just picking on the Jews, because the world is full of pseudo-Jews. Of course, Christianity is Jewish, of course. And many of those Christians are even worse than most Jews. The normal man is the man who loves and feasts and fights and hunts, the predatory man. The abnormal man is he who toils for a master, half starves and thinks, the Christly dog, every belief that makes a duty of humility, that inspires a people with moral courage, only enervates their fiber, corrupts their spirit, and prepares them first for thraldom and then for throttling. It is not possible to conceive of grand life without incessant rivalry, perpetual warfare, and the implacable hunting of man by man. Terror, torture, agony, and the wholesale destruction of feeble and worn-out types must mark in future as in the past. Every step forward or backward in evolution, homoculture, and racial displacement. The soil of every nation is an arena, a stamping ground, where only the most vigorous animals may hope to hold their own. What is all history but the epic of colossal campaign, the final Armageddon, of which is never likely to be fought, because when men cease to fight, they cease to be men. This old earth is strewn to the very mountaintops with the fleshless skulls and the rain-bleached bones of perished combatants in countless myriads. Every square foot, every inch of soil contains its man. The evolution, or de-evolution, of mankind demands the perpetual transfiguration of one man into another, continuous reincarnation, eternal rebirth, and reconstruction. Scientifically considered, the resurrection of the dead is not an illusion. Every living organism is formed from the decomposed essence of pre-existent organism. The man of today is actually built out of a grave mold of his prototypes, perhaps of ages long forgotten. Thus, without death, there could be no birth material, and without conflict fierce and deadly, there could be no surpassing. But to individuals foolishly trained to bewail their fate, all these commonplace facts are agonizing. Quote, when we solemnly look upon the perpetual conflict, unquote, writes Schelling, with true theocratic pessimism, quote, it fills us with shuddering sorrow and with boundless alarm. But how can we help it? Hence the veil of sadness that spread all over all nature, the deep, indestructible melancholy of all life, unquote. Like many other philosophers, deceived by appearance, Schelling fancies savage and dreadful that which is pure, mischievous, that which is preservative and calamitous, that which is benign. The flow of destruction is a natural and as needful as the flow of water. No human ingenuity can destroy the immolation of man or prevent the shedding of blood. And why should it? Majestic nature continues on her tragic way, serenely, caring not for the wails of the agonized and panic-stricken, nor the protests of defeat, but smiling sadly, proudly, yet somewhat disdainfully in her passing stride at the victor's fierce hurrah. She loves the writhing of the sword blades, rending of tradition, the crunching of bones, and the flap of shredded, shotten banners, streaming out savagely in the night and in the day, over the battle-weary, the mangled dying, the swollen dead. Christ may come and Christ may go, but Caesar is forever. Deep, permanent, and abiding is the elemental antagonism between the sociology of the man of Nazareth and the imprescriptible laws of the universe. They are as fire and water to each other, irreconcilable. Indeed, our planetary system itself shall melt with fervent heat, or the Galilean's philosophy can conquer. No human being can ever hope to attain the perfectibility that is Christ. So long as we remain animals, we shall be dominated by animal wants and animal passions and animal rivalries. Undoubtedly, the Messiah ideal is unattainable, hopeless, and especially so upon the reformatory side. However, the world loves to be deceived by some ghastly delusion, and that the reason, perhaps, that is taken to its bosom this rustic fable, this gospel of ineffectuality, this evangel of darkness, this dream of an Israelite slave. When the Assyrians, and after them the Medes and the Persians, writes Tacitus, were masters of the Oriental world, the Jews of all nations then held in subjection were deemed the most contemptible. Christ was a pariah Jew. Among viral conquering tribes, the ideal man is ever the all-daring Jove, the splendid Apollo, the self-reliant Achilles, or the constructive genius. It is only in centuries of dotage, in the ages of cankersome, down-going and nervous disease, that the model man becomes a Christ. The model man of our forefathers was Odin, a warlord, but our ideal man is a weeping, horse-whipped Jew, a Jew for God. The deities of the Greeks and the Vikings, the Goths and the Romans, were all originally mighty men of valor, or virile women of unsurpassed beauty, afterwards held up before their warlike posterity as splendid examples of natural nobility, conscious power, daring courage, shrewdness, sexual vigor and boundless strength of character. The gods and heroes of antiquity spent their vital force in the destruction of monsters, in the seizure of new hunting grounds, in the slaughter of tyrants, and in the breeding of unconquerable sons. But Christ, the God of Christendom, the divine exemplar, the majestic figure, what godlike deed did he ever do? What unconquerable sons did he ever beget? If the first principle of Christianity should be, by an unforeseen miracle, triumphed in the elemental conflict that is approaching, assuredly the Anglo-Saxon is played out, his days are numbered, his dominion ended, his sepulcher prepared. Multitudinous multiplication of unfit millions, broods of strumous semi-idiots, must then proceed through the dreary, barren, brain-paralyzing centuries, winding up perhaps in a blast of pestilential plague, a black death. The dead and alive conditions of the celestial empire will then be applied to this Western world, and under this disguise of advancement, progress, civilization, an atmosphere of excruciating torture must be artificially created, hostile to all but degenerative forces, as in China. In the name of goodness, righteousness, and morality, woe shall be poured out upon our seed, as it has already been poured out on the rotten swarms of the Orient. Congenital enfeeblement of body, together with the organic degeneracy of mind, must then go on and on at an ever-accelerating ratio until our posterity may end as Darwin imagined. We began by becoming chattering apes without sense enough to light a fire, crack a coconut, or swing by our tails. Behold the modern man, this heir of all ages, in the foremost ranks of time. His sight, taste, smell, and hearing are all notoriously defective. He can harness thunderbolts, but the unerring instinct of a carrier pigeon is beyond him. His brain has become an overheated thinking engine, but he may not read the daily morning layer without spectacles. He understands more things, or thinks he does, but if suddenly removed from his artificial environment, he would perish as helplessly as the babes in the woods. He can gauge sound waves, photograph broken bones, construct giant iron monsters, whisper across the miles of copper wire, but when the pointer dog sniffs the hidden pheasant from afar off, this erudite bundle of nerves looks on in blank amazement. The fact is that the civilized man is gradually losing his senses. If he continues to progress at the existing rate, in a comparatively little while he will have no smell, no sight, and no hearing. Dire visions, worse foreboding, glare upon me through the gloom. Europe's smoke cloud sinks corroding on the land in noisome fume, showering down like rain of ashes on the city of God's doom. Bustling smug, a pygmy pack plucks its prey from ore embraces, walks with crooked soul and back, glares like dwarfs with greedy eyes, for the golden glitter lies. It is good for a degraded people to be utterly consumed. In the Department of Natural History, it is axiomatic that all kinds of living beings, from protozoa to man, subsist and propagate through and by the destruction of feebler competitors belonging to the same species or to kindred species. That's what makes it so absolutely maddening that a black race is allowed to not only exist side by side, but assume leadership over white Aryans. It's absolutely, naturally insane. Thus the big fish eat the little fish, the big trees, by absorbing and monopolizing the nutrient, eat up the little trees. The strong animals eat the weak animals, and so on ad infinitum. Man is no exception. Conquering and masterful nations have ever been ravenous devourers of flesh food, and most of them have also been man-eaters. The slaughterhouses of Christendom reek with the dying effluvia of millions and millions of butchered brutes. That man, the king of animals, may day by day eat flesh, drink blood, and gnaw bones. Even cannibalism is not extinct in far lands, nor quite unknown in the centers of our proudest civilizations. With the first great revolutionary cataclysm, its revival upon a gigantic scale is not an improbability. During the 11th century, man's flesh was cooked, sold, and eaten in England. An Englishman may again revert to anthropology, anthropophagy, if ever their imported food supply should be suddenly and entirely cut off, either by convulsions of nature or acts of war. Shipwrecked crews have repeatedly saved themselves by casting lots and devouring some of their number, and shipwrecked nations loaded up to the hatches with seething cargoes of festering, useless nondescripts may yet be driven to do the same. Innumerable are folklore legends relating to ancient and modern man-eaters. Formal human sacrifices upon the altars of idols are quite common. In Mexico and ancient Britain, prelates butchered their victims, generally young virgins, in public amid the acclaim of musical instruments, the chanting of beautiful liturgies, and the hosanna shouts of the mob. The modern prelate does not employ the rude smoking gully knife, but uses other weapons, 10 times more keen and more destructive. For every human sacrifice offered up in olden times, millions are offered up now. Professor Huxley pictorially describes an African butcher's shop where human steaks, roasts, and sirloins were systematically retailed. Josephus tells us of mothers who ate their own infants during the last siege of Jerusalem, and in many later sieges, human flesh has been consumed. Oriental traditions record that King Richard Lionheart, that once upon a time when presiding at a feast of Muslim heads, he remarked with grim matter-of-factness, "One roast sarsisin made good entertainment for 9 or 10 of my good Christian men." An English crusading rhymer is even proud of this. To wit, "King Richard shall warrant, there is no flesh so nourishing unto the English man, partridge, plover, heroin, he swam, cow, nay ox, sheep, nay swine, as the roast head of a Saracen." That was a Muslim individual in North Africa. And for those Christians that yap about, well, Christianity never did these things, tell them they're full of shit. The very intelligent New Zealand Aboriginals may still be found who describe with much apparent gusto how, in comparatively recent dates, they satiated their ravenous hunger by banqueting all night upon the grilled flesh of foemen they had tomahawked during the day. Neither is it uncommon to hear tattooed old veterans tell how war captives were penned up like cattle and fattened upon each another until required by the tribal oven, formed of red-hot stones paved into an oval hollow in the ground. How then the fattest were selected, one by one taken out, systematically bled, disemboweled and hung by the heels on the neighboring trees, just as sheep, swine, and cattle are exposed for sale in our own abattoirs and meat markets. The Maoris also have a tradition that if a man kills and eats his enemy, he, by doing so, absorbs all the dead man's vitality, strength, and courage. In the nascent colony of New Zealand, missionaries, soldiers, and whalers and pioneers were often cooked and eaten, but by a general consensus of Epicurean opinion, the paksha's flesh was voted bad form, principally because it was too tough and too salty. In Africa, of course, they used to call it long pig when they butchered a white man or some other person. During the War of Secession, northern infantrymen accidentally imprisoned in a Virginian mine devoured each other one at a time. The last man, John Ewing, died of hunger, and leaving a written record of the facts sealed up in a flask. The story of Sonny Bean is well known, also the classical legend of Cyclops, the giants, the Phalaris bull, the Moloch Holocaust, and the Homer's Polyphemus. Anthropology has been practiced in anthropophagy. I guess that's cannibalism. Has been practiced in Australia both by whites and black fellows. In New Guinea, the portions of Africa, man-eating is quite an ordinary custom to this hour. Marcus Clark describes how Gabbett, an English-born Botany Bay convict, induced his prison comrades to escape with him into the bush in order that he might have a holiday and a feast, picking their succulent bones and sucking out the marrow therein. All over the continent of Europe, there is a popular superstition of Jew rabbis steal and murder Christian infants and maidens in order to use the blood for their door lintels at Passover and other ceremonies. A similar charge was brought against the early Christians and even proved in the imperial law courts, if we are to be judged the verdicts. Human fat is regularly retailed in modern drugstores, and human heads are even now a remarkable commodity in the South Seas. There are also mystic brotherhoods in our midst whose initiates pledge fidelity and obligate themselves to a lifelong secrecy by drinking blood out of the skull over emblems of violent death with daggers pointed at their throats. The foundation stones of many famous buildings, palaces, castles, temples, and monuments have been emblematically laid upon the living body of a man. The Kremlin, for example. Is not communism service allegorical anthropophagy? Is it not pious periodical cannibal feast in more ways than one? Does not the wine symbolize human blood and wafers typify human flesh? Metaphorically considered, every trading Christian state is a meat market wherein the flesh and bones and blood not only of men but women and little children are bought and sold daily, offered up nominally for the love of God, really for the love of dollars. Atrocities of the most revolting description are of daily, hourly occurrence, not only in Turkey and Siam but in New York and Chicago, not only in Cuba and Port Arthur but in London, Madrid, Paris, not only in Mashonaland, but on the Congo, but in St. Petersburg and Berlin. Men and women and little children are being everywhere starved slowly to the grave, worked till they fall down, driven insane by legislation, and even tortured to death inch by inch. Great financial corporations, backed by the state, directed mostly by Hebrews, literally coined great empires into golden dividends, and upon the shared list of mortgage banks and man-devouring institutions generally may be found the names of bishops, popes, preachers, generals, governors, statesmen, and other human carnivores by the thousand. He who doubts should look up the official share registers and behold the long rows of adorable names belonging to high priests, philanthropists, and rulers appearing thereon. Cannibalism was practiced in ancient Greece at the period of the highest culture. Herodotus describes Asian feasts where man's flesh was the chief dish. And down to the 13th century, the Tibetans were in habit of making their parents into broth. There are confraternities still in existence into which no one is ever admitted until he has first killed a man. Among the Dyaks, as among our own ancestors, a youth is never considered a full-grown person capable of founding a home until he has slain at least one enemy in battle. The Thugs of India, a religious sect, brought the science of holy murder by its strategic violence to such a pitch of perfection that they have never been surpassed, not even by Grant or Mulkey. The Kinderwas of India make a regular practice of eating all their diseased, useless, senile, and decrepit relations, just as pack of wolves fall upon any of their number that is seriously wounded in a foray. In portions of Sumatra, lawbreakers are neither imprisoned nor electrocuted, but actually carved up and eaten alive, piece by piece. Boy, wouldn't that be nice wouldn't that be nice of George Jr., after all the deaths he caused? The Camagagugas of South America make of their own stomachs the sepulcher of their dead relatives. A funeral with them is a banquet, the coalition being a corpse. The Terra del Fuegians throttle and eat all very old women. The Mount Buddhas of Central Africa carry on aggressive wars to capture flesh food. They also dry human flitches in the sun and smoke them for export. During the Taiping Rebellion, Chinese soldiers under General Gordon were in the habit of cutting out and devouring the hearts of their dead enemies on the battlefield, like the Morays and the Britons. Mistresses were especially kept by opulent ancient Peruvians to breed sucklings for the table. When these women became too old for childbearing, then they were likewise cast into the pot as useless encumbrances. In 1782, more than 40 gypsies were executed in Austria upon a proven charge of cannibalism. The case of the herdsman Goldschmidt must not be forgotten, nor the gruesome London legends regarding sausages being manufactured out of dead cats, dead dogs, dead paupers, and murdered sailors. The ancient Scandinavian Teutons, Celts, Scythians, Mongols, Sarmatians, Canaanites, Goths, and Huns were all cannibals. Indeed, the detailed facts on how men have tortured each other for pleasure, revenge, or profit would fill 10,000 volumes. No man in his lifetime could read or comprehend all the horrors that have been perpetuated, say, in the Tower of London, the Paris Bastille, the Spanish Inquisition, the Rhine Castle dungeons by the bridges of Sighs, the Bosphorus, or in the prison hells of Chicago and California, Newgate, Mazes, Siberia, Sing Sing, New Caledonia, Botany Bay, or Van Diemen's Land. The cold-blooded cruelty of man to man surpasses anything that poet Cranks could conceive of as happening in hell. Cannibalism undoubtedly originated amid overcrowding populations in some prehistoric age. Among moderns, civilized and savage, it merely exists as a survival of social conditions which have long since passed away. At some former era of the world's profoundly mysterious history, men animals increased in swarming myriads, as they are doing now, until at last on the surface of the soil there was scarcely standing room for all. Then the air became laden with the reeking effluvia of their strumous bodies, breeding decimated pestilence, cholera, smallpox, leprosy, poisoning the wells and rivers, and transforming Babylon into carnal houses and tombs. The rearing of tame cattle for food in such an environment probably became too inexpensive and cumbersome. Perhaps even the cattle would also be swept away by some blight or rinderpest. Under such horrible circumstances, survivors might from necessity resort to cannibalism. Gradually, the new habit would grow upon them and become a settled custom. The segmental fragments of prehistoric civilizations are the cannibal savages of today, the savages that we are displacing, pushing aside in order that we may enslave them and repeat over again some weary old round of growth, power, and decay. Shiploads of dead soldiers dug out of the old battlefields possess a regular commercial value. They're imported into England to be chemically treated and manufactured into fertilizers for enriching and exhausting wheat fields. Human hair commands a steady sale, and cadavers may be bought for dissection in any great city for a dollar COD. The tanning of human skins for glove making and body making or book making is an old established industry. The transfusion of blood from animals into human veins and from healthy humans into unhealthy ones for a price is regularly practiced by medical men. The grafting of flesh, bone, and skin has also been successfully performed. American sheriffs and detectives hunt down tramps, criminals with especially trained bloodhounds, just as the Russians hunt wolves and sheep farmers hunt coyotes and dingoes. It is nowise unusual for Negroes to be first captured, then chained to a stake, flayed alive, soaked with kerosene, and burnt to death amid existent shrieks of corybantic delight. Roman senators fattened their lampreys and eels upon the drowning bodies of old worn-out slaves, and patrician maids and matrons with uplifted thumb sent many a gladiator to kingdom come for inmates' cruelty of deed. No animal can surpass women. In the Mohammedan Europe, boys were unisexed by lancet, that they were therefore be more safely employed as harem attendants. And in Christian Europe, eunuchs are made and trained and picked to sing the praise of the risen Christ. Well, I think that's about enough for today, boys and girls. See if I can find a bookmark here. I think every one of you should have a copy of this. Might is Right, The Survival of the Fittest by Ragnar Redbeard. Bring your feet back down to earth and understand what you're dealing with. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Thursday. Think about it. If you think you're ever going to escape the problem we're up against, you're going to have to understand and employ the weapons of the ancients and get rid of all this so-called sentimentality of religion and Christianity.